Shalom, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Eddie Chavez Calderon here, campaign director at Arelit Sedeck. Super happy to have all of you here joining us in this great day today, this morning filled with lots of learning. We're super excited to have Rabbanit Bracha Jaffe, who received her smicha from Yeshiva Maharat and serves as an associate rabbi at the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale in the Bronx. Beautiful, gorgeous place, by the way. She is grateful for the opportunity to teach Torah classes, instruct the conversational programs, answer halachic questions, and facilitate tefillot, offered pastoral guidance, craft life cycle events, and connect with families and singles, young and old. She has taught many lane, and her voice is featured on the JOFA website, reading for Megillot and selected Torah portions. In HIR, the children know her as the rabbi who sings Israeli children's songs and gives out stickers. I love that. Rabbanit Bracha is passionate about bringing in mental illness out of the shadows and has spoken about it in different settings. She loves connecting people to each other and encouraging them to be their best selves. Some of her favorite pastimes are kickboxing and reading books to her grandchildren. Rabbanit Bracha lives in Riverdale, New York with her husband, Martin. Wow, I love this. Such amazing, what an amazing bio. We're super excited to have you here, Rabbi Jaffe. So excited. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Eddie, for that introduction. And I'm excited. I just want to say hello to people who are on Torah Teens. I wonder if that's one or more Torah Teens. Or maybe you lead Torah Teens, or you are a Torah Teen, but welcome. Dahlia Ginsberger, thank you so much for joining. Emma's iPhone, so I can't see you. Everybody, you're welcome to be on camera if you wish. Oh, thank you, Emma, but you don't have to be. And Ilana Bruce and Eliezer Weinbach. Happy to see everybody who came on. It is easier to teach when there are people on the other end. And again, you're welcome to put yourself on camera, but you don't have to. I really have the joy of teaching one of my favorite stories in the Gemara. The Gemara is full of stories. Eddie, let me just check with you. Should I be translating every word that I use into English? Is that what that?
Up to you.
It's up to me. Okay, I just don't know exactly who the target audience is. And I just want to say, since not everybody who will be watching this is here today, that what I have here is 151. It's the number of days that the hostages have been held in Gaza since October 7th. And that's what I change. I try to do it every single day. Somebody who may come on in a few years, let's say, they say, why is she wearing a number? That's the reason I wear it. It's a way to keep them close to my heart and my consciousness. And that's a very teeny thing that I can do, but still meaningful to the families of the hostages. Okay, so back to what we were talking about. I am excited. Hello, welcome, Isaac Blumenthal. I am excited to teach this story, the story of Rabban Gamliel, the Talmud, which is, you know, a huge, huge amount of books, has recorded many conversations between rabbis, between sages, many discussions back and forth, and it also has something called Agadata. Agadata is the stories, and they were very thoughtful about what stories they put in and how they wrote the stories. So what we're going to do is we're going to read the story, and I will highlight certain words. We'll talk about the story. One of the reasons that I love the story is that there are so many heroes in this story from my point of view. So we will go down and then we will lift up the people as we go along. And I think there's so much for us to learn from a story like this. Okay, background. Who was Rabban Gamliel? One of the first things we need to know is that there was more than one Rabban Gamliel. This one was a great, great, great grandson of Hillel HaZaken. Hillel the Elder, you may have heard of him, Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai. They're the ones who set up these great houses that were almost always in machloket, in controversy with each other, in halachic Jewish law discussions, but they also respected each other. And one of the beautiful things that we learn is that even though Hillel and Shammai were in sort of contention with each other. They married in between the families. It wasn't a Romeo and Juliet where you're not allowed to be friends with the one from the other house, meaning that, or for the other dynasty, because these were all machlokot l'shem shamayim. These were all disputes for the sake of heaven to really know the, to really know what the law is. Just to remind you that their most famous dispute is on Hanukkah. Do you light the candles going up or going down? Do you light one first nights, two the second night, three the third night, all the way up to eight, which is the way that we do it, and that's the way that Hillel says? Or do you start with eight and go 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, which is more about the potential, so the potential left meaning. Well, we're not going into that. I just wanted to tell you who Hillel was and that Rabban Gamliel comes from his dynasty. Rabban Gamliel was the first person to lead the Sanhedrin, the high court, as Nasi, as president, after the fall of the Second Temple, which occurred in 70 CE. Now, let me explain to you what happened to give you a little bit of background. Let's remember that after the fall of the Second Temple, the Jewish people were despondent. They could not imagine what Jewish life might look like without a temple. The temple was the center of their life, the center of their social fabric, religious fabric. It's if you belong to a shul, a synagogue, imagine that that was the focal point, and that Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah, that all Torah came out of the temple and out of Jerusalem. So the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, is destroyed. They have from their teachings, they know, this is the lore that's handed down, that there will only be two temples in their lifetime, that the third temple will be forever, and it'll happen at some point when the Messiah comes, Mashiach. And they didn't think the Mashiach was coming tomorrow, especially when they saw the ruins of the temple. And we have photographs, or paintings rather, not photographs, of the Jews sitting and literally sitting shiva, like you do for somebody who died. They rent their garments and put on sackcloth. Hello, Helen. Welcome. And they did that because they couldn't imagine what could be left. It's as if their whole Judaism died. And the sages were then tasked to reimagine Judaism. What could Judaism look like that will feel powerful, fruitful, and like it has a future? And they did something brilliant, actually. I did a few things, but the first thing they did was reimagine it, that instead of having one seat of power or Jewish law or one central place where everybody tends to come to, they said, no, Beit Mikdash, the big one, the big edifice, the big place, that's now going to, if you could imagine, sparks of its holiness being spread out so that every shul, every synagogue, every Beit Midrash, every study hall now has a spark of the Beit HaMikdash. So these little sparks can, wherever Jews are, and they create a shul or a place to gather for studying or for praying, for davening, there we have a mini Beit HaMikdash. And they gave the power back, in a sense, to the people, saying, you can create the next level of Judaism. At the same time, they also recorded many of the stories and the machlokot, the decisions, the discussions, the controversies that had been kept orally for many years, because they realized as the Jews dispersed around the world, they may lose this knowledge. So they wrote down what was called the Oral Torah into the Written Torah, which is, sorry, not into the Written Torah, but they wrote it down. They took the Oral Torah, which was these discussions among the sages. And Rabban Gamliel lived around that time. Now let's go back to the summary. He was appointed Nasi, president, approximately 10 years after the fall of the Second Temple. And he actually rendered immense service. Why? Because he was tough. He was tough in the sense that he acted on whatever he believed in, and he was a person of strong moral conviction, strong, very inner strength. Really, he never compromised on his values, which, as we all know, is great until you bump up against something that doesn't feel so great for other people. On one hand, that's exactly what the Jewish people needed. On the other hand, he took it too far. That's really what happened. That's the limits. Rabbinic authority cannot just be forever. You can't shame people. You can't embarrass. You can't put people down. And that's what he did because he was so strongly working on his own convictions. So you can read also as oh no, that the people on the phone counts. Okay, so he's appointed Nasi approximately 10 years later, rendered immense service in strengthening and reintegration of Judaism, which had been deprived of the base, the strong base for the Second Temple, and losing political autonomy in Israel. He put an end to the division which had arisen between the spiritual leaders of Judaism by the separation of the sages into two schools called, as I said, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. And he took care to enforce his own authority. Sometimes you need somebody to make a decision and move the ball forward. You can't, at that point, when there were seats in different places, he became the moral code, the voice of authority. Took care to enforce his own authority as the president of the Chief Legal Assembly of Judaism with a lot of energy and often with severity. He did this, as he himself said, not for his own honor, and I believe that. It was not for his own honor, nor for the honor of his family. His family already had honor, but in order that disunion should not prevail in Israel. I have to say, this one, this shiur is something I've given in different ways in the past. This is pre-October 7th, but look at how important and how we feel even today. We have learned that disunion can cause us to really be weak when the Jewish people are attacked, whether it's physically being attacked in Israel or whether it's being attacked through anti-Semitism. So that prevails till today. According to the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah, that is the oral Torah that was written down, in a dispute between Rabban Gamliel II and Rabbi Yehoshua regarding the exact date of Yom Kippur, Rabban Gamliel ordered Rabbi Yehoshua to appear before him on his, meaning Rabbi Yehoshua's Yom Kippur. If you, I don't know if you know this, but the Rosh Chodesh, the first day of the lunar month, which is how all of our holidays are determined. Rosh Hashanah is the first day of Tishrei. Yom Kippur is the 10th day of Tishrei. Sukkot is the 15th day of Tishrei. And every month, witnesses had to come and say, "We saw the moon, it looked like this. We saw the moon, the new moon, that little teeny sliver. We saw it," and they had photographs, not again, not photographs, sorry, drawings of what the sky looked like in every month. And they would check the witnesses and make sure. So only when the witnesses came could they say that Rosh Chodesh was on, let's say, Monday or Tuesday, because that's the way the lunar months work outside the topic of this discussion for now, but just take my word for it. So Rabbi Yehoshua, who was very, very knowledgeable, he didn't agree when Yom Kippur should be. And Rabban Gamliel, in order to enforce his role and his position as the head of this Sanhedrin, of this court, high court, he ordered Rabbi Yehoshua to appear before him on his, meaning Rabbi Yehoshua's Yom Kippur, carrying his stick. If there's no Eruv, you're not allowed to carry, so that would be desecrating his Yom Kippur. Let's say he thought it was Monday, and Rabban Gamliel and the sages had decided it was Tuesday. So he said, "You have to come to me on Monday when you think it's your Yom Kippur, because I want to show all of the Jews that you were only following one authority, one halachic authority. We cannot have a dispute." And think about it. If the calendar, if we don't agree, somebody once said something very smart to me. They said, whether or not you come to a Seder, everybody agrees when the Seder is. You might say, "I don't go to Seders." But everybody agrees that it's on that night. Nobody says, "Oh no, it's on a different night." Everybody agrees to the calendar. It's one of the few things that all Jews basically agree on. Nobody's arguing with that. But if you have people who say, "No, Yom Kippur is really on Monday, not on Tuesday," then Sukkot is really on, a different day, that can throw the whole union of Jews davening, praying together, reading the Torah together, it just and eating together and celebrating holidays. There has to be one day. So he made him come carrying his stick, which is one a biblical prohibition if there's no Eruv, carrying his money bag, which is a second prohibition, it's rabbinic probably to carry money, to establish the Nasi, his own authority. According to a Talmudic account, after further humiliations of Rabbi Yehoshua by Rabban Gamliel, the latter, meaning Rabban Gamliel, was deposed for a time from the office of Nasi. If we were able to have a discussion, we would talk about it, but we'll have the discussion later at the end. I'm going to present it to you, tell you the story, and then I'd be so happy, so happy. Even you can even drop in the chat in the meantime, and Eddie, we can, look at them later. could be some of your questions will be answered as we go along. So this just gives a list. And by the way, Eddie, if you want, I'm happy to share the source sheet that which you can add afterwards to the recording so people can access it as well. Otherwise, they won't know what I'm talking about. Okay. These are the different Rabbangam Leos. We're going to put them aside for now. Now let us get to the story. It is found in Tractate Brachot, which means blessings, on the page number. That's how you show a Gemara. I don't actually have a Gemara in here. Oh, I do. Sorry, one second. So Gemara, they're often even bigger books, but the way you find where you are, let me open to the Hebrew section, is every page is numbered. This is what a typical Gemara looks like, by the way. Every page is numbered, and it's numbered on, let's say, 26, so you have side A and side B. That's where you can find this story. Our rabbis taught a certain disciple, he's not named, by the way, which is really interesting because when you don't name someone, it doesn't matter what their name is. We're not remembering his name. He is only a part of the story, but he's the part of the story that sets up the important part of the story, which teaches us that it's not about what he did, but it's about how Rabban Gamliel responded. I want to repeat that. The people who are named are the people that are the purpose, the goal of telling this story. And if this disciple, why not just say his name, whatever his name? Now, it could have been lost over time, but I would imagine they might have known who he was, but it wasn't important because what's important is to talk about Rabban Gamliel and what he did to Rabbi Yoshua. A certain disciple came before Rabbi Yoshua and asked him, so this is a halachic question. You may know there are three tefillot, three prayers. We say they were set up by Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. There's the morning one called Shacharit or Shachris. The second afternoon prayer is Mincha or Mincha. And the evening prayer is called Mariv or Arvit. It's actually called both. But those names, both of them have the word Erev in it, which means evening. So we have morning, we have afternoon, and we have evening. And it is really unclear, it was unclear, if this evening prayer, doesn't matter what the halachic basis is, that's out of the scope of what we're discussing, was it obligatory like the morning prayer and the afternoon prayer, which everybody agreed was obligatory. So he comes to Rabbi Yoshua. Remember, Rabbi Yoshua is the one who was shamed already at least once. Actually, he was shamed twice already, I believe. And asked him, is the evening tefillah obligatory or optional? Rabbi Yoshua answered, it's optional. Which, by the way, that is how we hold, except that over time, the Jews accepted it on themselves. So it has a weaker halachic basis because it's taken on in a voluntary fashion. It is made obligatory by the Jews at the time taking it on. But the actual requirement halachically for prayer, prayer that is prescribed, is the morning and afternoon prayer. Okay, great. Until here, we're good. He, meaning the certain student, presented himself before Rabban Gamliel. Now, I don't know why he did this. It seems like he's sowing seeds of doubt or discontent. I'm not sure why he decided to ask one. Maybe you've heard you don't shop around for rabbi. Maybe he really didn't believe Rabbi Yeshua or wasn't sure. I'm not sure what happened. He's my one person who's not so much my hero in this story. Because he seems to be sowing doubt and creating a ruckus where perhaps it wasn't necessary. On the other hand, sometimes when you look at a complicated story and you see the ending, you say, even though there were pieces on the way that felt hard, the end result was excellent. And because the end result was excellent, maybe God placed him there and put in his head to ask first Rabbi Yoshua and then Rabban Gamliel in order for the next steps to take place. So keep that in mind. Eddie, I'm just like, I can see you, so you can nod or tell me that wasn't clear. That would be really helpful. Or Helen, because I think everybody else, I'm not sure if they're on camera. Okay. So then presents himself before Rabban Gamliel, who remember, he's the Nasi, he's the president, he's number one, and asked him, is the same question, is the evening tefillah obligatory or optional? And he, Rabban Gamliel, replied, it's obligatory. Uh-oh. One says optional, one says obligatory. So the student said, and here's where I'm like, really? Did not Rabbi Yoshua tell me that it's optional? So I think we can already see Rabban Gamliel knowing, which, because I told you, that he had already come up against Rabbi Yehoshua, that this is not going to bode well for Rabbi Yehoshua. And maybe Rabban Gamliel will continue in the vein that he did before, which had to do with, remember, if Rabbi Yehoshua has to come before him on his Yom Kippur, meaning Monday, let's say, instead of Tuesday, with his walking stick and his money bag, people see him. Those were small areas where people lived. They didn't live all spread out. They didn't have cars. Everybody would have seen Rabbi Yehoshua walking to Rabban Gamliel on the day that everybody knew Rabbi Yehoshua thought was his Yom Kippur. So he's already shamed him in some way. Rabban Gamliel answered him, "Wait until the men of armor, Ba'alei Trisin, enter the Beit Midrash." Now, it's an interesting turn of phrase to say the men of armor. I can't tell you if they're recording exactly Rabban Gamliel's words, maybe. But it's, as I said at the beginning, when you read a story in the Talmud, they are very thoughtful about how they wrote the stories. What did they include? What did they leave out? So we have kind of permission to read all the nuance of the story and try to understand what's being presented to us. So who comes into the Beit Midrash? It's not people in armor. Who comes into a Beit Midrash? It's the rabbis. It's the sages. That's who come in to a study hall. So are they men of armor because they're armed with Torah? Are they men of armor because Rabban Gamliel saw them as his soldiers in the army of who is going to set the halakha, the Jewish law? But it adds an element of unfriendliness and an overtone of strictness and severity, which didn't feel so necessary by using this term. And we all know that words make a difference. The words that you use make a difference in how people hear you. You can say the same thing in two different ways. Somebody was telling me yesterday, we were talking about an opera. And the person said to me, we're talking about an oratorio, which is a new word for me, where the orchestra is on stage, and also there are opera singers, but minimal play settings or cast settings, because mostly you see the whole orchestra and you see the choir. And he said to me, "So that's so the audience can get a kick out of seeing the orchestra?" And I thought, that's reducing the role of the orchestra. It's true. It's so that the audience can enjoy and appreciate the orchestra and not just the opera. I agree. But somehow, when you use different words, it brings an overtone. So this to me brought an overtone of levity. Now, that person didn't do it on purpose. That was the phrase that that person used. But I think words are very important. And one of the things that we already learn, one of the first lessons we're learning, be careful how you speak, because the way you speak really makes a difference. Okay. So now the Gemara continues. In the Gemara, we have stories, but we also have a narration. So the narrator says, when the men of armor, so the narrator continues, as if looking at it from the point of view of Rabban Gamliel. So we're now in Rabban Gamliel's shoes, behind Rabban Gamliel's eyes, and his men of armor came in, meaning the sages, and he's ready to go out to war with Rabbi Yehoshua. Now, the thing is, Rabbi Yehoshua is actually also one of the men of armor. By the way, it is all men. There were no women then. I get it. Just saying it, just putting it out there. But I'm very honored as a woman to be able to tell this story. So the men of armor come in, again, including Rabbi Yehoshua, except from Rabban Gamliel's point of view, I think he thinks of them as his army. The questioner, meaning the student, stood up and said, "Is the evening tefillah obligatory or optional?" Rabban Gamliel immediately replied, remember, he's the Nasi, he's the president. He said, "It's obligatory." And that's exactly what he said before. If you look here, exactly what he said before was that it's obligatory. So he's repeating his stand. We haven't heard from Yehoshua. Rabban Gamliel then said to the sages, now we know all of those men of armor are the sages. If you didn't believe me before, now you understand. This is who came, because he waited till they came in. Is there anyone here who disputes this? And what does Rabbi Yehoshua say? No, because Rabbi Yehoshua did not want to start a fight in front of Rabban Gamliel and not in front of the whole Beit Midrash. He didn't want it. He seems to believe more in a peaceful resolution. But Rabban Gamliel wasn't willing to let it go. He needed to know that Rabbi Yoshua, even in his private room, when somebody comes and asks him, what is the answer to this question, that Rabbi Yoshua will follow whatever it is that Rabban Gamliel said. So Rabban Gamliel does not let it go. Like, took a what did it, put the bit in his teeth, he won't let it go. Rabbi Yoshua said no. He, meaning Rabban Gamliel, just put that in there, make it easier for people. It is always hard, by the way, in the Gemara, it's always he. So you got to read into it which he it is. Rabban Gamliel said to him, did they not report you to me as saying that it is optional? Meaning, I don't believe you now. That is not the way you hold, or that's kind of yeshivish term for how you decide the halacha. If you were a halachic decisor, you would say that it's optional. It didn't matter. And actually, Rabban Gamliel set the whole thing up to get to this point. It didn't make any difference that Rabbi Yoshua, in the moment, was willing to acquiesce. It made no difference to Rabban Gamliel. Now, if you just look at the scene from that point of view, it's pretty upsetting because Rabban Gamliel didn't have to do this in front of everybody. But let's look for a moment from Rabban Gamliel's point of view. It's so important to him that everybody knows that you have to follow one halakha. However that halakha is decided, and Rabban Gamliel is the final decider, I think, decisor, but that we can't have disunity within the nation. And for Rabban Gamliel, he, as I said before, he doesn't really see nuance in how to put these words into action. That was really the problem here. The whole story is about how Rabban Gamliel did not know how to act. They were fine with his insides. They were fine with who he was and what he represented from a values point of view and from halachic knowledge point of view. And even more than anything else, being able to pull the nation together. But he went too far. He doesn't wait for Rabbi Yoshua to answer him. Didn't they report to you to me saying that it's optional? He then went on, meaning Rabbi Gamliel. Yoshua, stand on your feet and let them, your feet, testify against you. Okay? So right away, there's public shame immediately. It's like, go stand in the corner. Everybody's sitting, clearly everybody's sitting. That's how they had discussions, was sitting around the table. Same thing today in a Beit Midrash in a study hall, sitting around the table. But there's also something more. So there's a little nuance in here that you wouldn't know unless I told you, or you knew it from some other source. He has 2 feet and he's only one person. So it's as if Rabban Gamliel is saying to him, by you standing up, your 2 feet are like two witnesses saying, I give in, I will never say again that the evening tefillah is optional, or is optional. Rabbi Yoshua stood up, he had no choice, which also just feels so icky. Probably not a word in the Gemara speak, but it's a word in my lexicon. Rabbi Yoshua stood up and said, were I alive and he's dead, the living could contradict the dead. But now that he's alive and I am alive, how can the living contradict the living? Okay, so this is a very fancy, flowery way of saying, you're right, he's here. If he wasn't alive to contradict me, then I could lie, basically, and say, no, that's not what I told him. But we're both alive and I can't just lie. I can't. So you're right. Basically saying, you're right. That is what I told the certain student who we still don't know his name. And I guess we never will. Now, I'm the one, by the way, who put in 2.1, 2.2, 2.3, just to show you different, just to break it up in a way that feels a little easier to follow. That is not the way it looks in the Gemara. In the Gemara, it's one long run-on sentence from the beginning to the end of everything. Rabban Gamliel remained sitting and expounding, and Rabbi Yoshua remained standing. So imagine everybody's sitting, Rabban Gamliel as if is ignoring the fact that he made Rabbi Yoshua stand. It's getting more and more and more uncomfortable in the room. People are starting to kind of mutter, what is he doing? This is terrible. Rabbi Yoshua is a great sage. He didn't do anything wrong. He just said his halachic opinion, and we don't like the way Rabban Gamliel is treating him. He remains sitting, and he's so dishonoring him. He's so dishonored. I mean, I'm just like, my skin crawls when I think about it. This is the seat of halachic power and authority. And in front of all of his peers, Rabban Gamliel is really publicly shaming. Now, there's an expression that shaming someone in public is akin to death. It's a kind of death. And that can be what it feels like. Shame is such a hard thing to live with. And the memory of the shame. Sorry, one second. Okay. Rabban Gamliel remained sitting, Rabbi Yehoshua remained standing until the entire nation called out. Who's the entire nation? They're not men of what was it called? Men of armor anymore. Now they're the entire, as if everybody else in the Beit Midrash represent the entire Jewish people. Everybody in the Beit Midrash is watching this play out. Rabban Gamliel is sitting and talking and learning as if Rabbi Yehoshua doesn't exist. Rabbi Yehoshua is standing, mortified, in shame. Everybody said, enough. You pushed us so far, you can't push us anymore. Again, that's being careful with the words, with the wording that they use. They called out and they said to chutzpit the orator, actually the Torgaman, the person who called out the teachings of Rabban Gamliel. Often there would be somebody who would, I guess, either had a louder voice, no microphones, and or explained what he said in a language that people would understand. And they said to him, stand, meaning stop speaking, ve'amad, and he stopped speaking. It's an expression that they use. Amod means stop in your tracks, basically, even though the physical word means stand. And chutzpit, the orator, who also probably didn't know what to do and where to put himself, seeing all this happening. So I can already tell you, Rabbi Yeshua in some ways is my hero because he was willing to do something for peace. He was willing to not say in front of everybody, no, I said it's actually optional. Remember he said, nope, no one disputes. And he's standing there and he's still feeling shamed. He didn't leave the room, which I thought was interesting. In other words, he's somehow enduring Rabban Gamliel's authority and not making a ruckus. And all the people in the room are also my heroes because they said, even though Rabban Gamliel is our leader, even though we appointed him, even though we think he's so important to the Jewish people, we cannot let him take it too far. So at this moment, like electricity in the room, they say, they get up on their feet, which also is beautiful. I think they get up on their feet. No, they called out. Maybe they got up on their feet, but they said, I would imagine they would just so that they would feel solidarity with Rabbi Yeshua, but maybe they didn't, but they said, stop. And in that moment, Rabban Gamliel must have felt, okay, must have started feeling something is off here that had never happened before. And he honestly did not understand that this was the wrong way to act. Find another way to resolve the problem. Continuing. They continue to now to discuss among themselves. So I imagine that not the whole, the whole Beit Midrash, I don't, let's just say there were 300 people there. I don't think they all had a discussion. They probably appointed a small subcommittee to discuss it. They then said, how long is he going to continue painting him? Like, how many times can we allow him to insult Rabbi Yehoshua? On Rosh Hashanah last year, he insulted him. He insulted him. Remember, that was about the Yom Kippur that he has to come to him with his staff and his money bag. He insulted him in the matter of the firstborn and the affair of Rabbi Tzadok. Two other examples, we don't need to go into them, where Rabban Gamliel embarrassed Rabbi Yehoshua. Now he insults him again. Enough. Let us depose him. Immediately, that's what they got to. That was their answer. We're done. We don't want him here anymore. He went too far. And they immediately go to the solution. Okay, who should we appoint instead? I just find that so interesting that they acted so quickly. Now, it may have taken a little bit longer, but I don't think it did. I think it was pretty quick. So they said, we can hardly appoint Rabbi Yehoshua because he's one of the parties involved, taking side. It just won't feel good. Rabban Gamliel will never accept his authority. We can hardly appoint Rabbi Akiva because Rabban Gamliel might bring a curse on him. And he had, because he has no ancestral merit. So either Rabbi Akiva was a convert or his father was a convert. He was very well known. He's actually considered second only to Moshe, to Moses. But they believed in this, that Rabban Gamliel might put some sort of a curse on him and he doesn't have any ancestral merit because he or his father was a convert. So these are two suggestions. And it shows you, by the way, who were the great rabbis in the Beit Midrash. Rabbi Yoshua, the one who's involved here. Rabbi Akiva is number two. He's in the one. Then they said, you know what? Let's appoint Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who is wise and he is rich, and the 10th in descent from Ezra. So wise you need, because somebody who's going to be the Nasi, the president, has to be wise in the ways of our halakha. Why does he need to be rich? So that nobody could bribe him. That's actually was an important It was an important characteristic that they thought of then. You don't want to be able to be bribed. And it meant that he hobnobbed with the authorities. And he's the 10th in descent from Ezra. That's Ezra and Nehemiah, the ones great prophets at there at the end of by Chronicles in our Tanakh, in our Bible. And they're the ones who are around in between the first two temples. So he's the 10th in descent. Remember what we said before, that the reason they didn't pick Rabbi Akiva is because he has no ancestral merit. Well, clearly Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah will have ancestral merit because he comes from Ezra, which is a wonderful line, a lineage. Okay. So they're pointing Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. He is why. Oh, here it is. So if anyone puts a question to him, he'll be able to answer it. He is rich, so if an occasion arises for paying court to Caesar, he'll be able to do so. So as I said, he moved with the upper echelons of society. He is 10th in descent from Ezra, so he has ancestral merit, and he, meaning Rabban Gamliel, cannot bring a curse on him. That's it. They made that decision. By the way, you may remember who Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is. I didn't put in the story here only because of time. But there was this, first of all, there's a story that he went home when they asked him if he would do it. He said, I have to go home and ask my wife. So I kind of love that part of the story. That might have to come back in again. It was very sweet. And she said to him, wait a minute, you're going to accept this honor? They deposed Rabban Gamliel. First time you do something they don't like, they'll depose you. And he said, you know what? I hear you, but I'm being called to be a leader and I cannot turn it down. And the other reason you might recognize him is because he's in the Seder, in the Haggadah on Pesach night. He says, Hare ani kiven shivim shana. I am as if I am 70 years of age. Why? Because he was only 18 at the time. Now, how many times do you appoint an 18-year-old to be head of the rabbinical court? Probably zero. But he had the merit that they needed. He had the ancestral merit, he had money, and he was wise and knowledgeable, even at 18. So there was, according to our lore, there was a miracle that night. He was afraid that he wouldn't be accepted by people. Like, who are you? You barely have a beard. You know, like, why should we listen to you? And overnight, 18 locks of hair turned white. So that's why he said, I'm as if I'm 70 years old, because my hair is white. So hopefully people will recognize that. Then that God made a miracle and they will respect my knowledge. And he was appointed. And then, Oto Hayom, on that day, throughout the Gemara, wherever it says Oto Hayom that day, it is referring to this day when Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was put as a Nasi, as the president, instead of Rabban Gamliel. And they said so many things, wonderful things happened that day. What was one of them? The doorkeeper was removed, and permission was given for the disciples to enter. For Rabban Gamliel had issued a proclamation that no disciple whose interior did not correspond to his exterior may enter the Beit HaMidrash. And on that day, many benches were added. So I want to tell you the story behind that. Rabban Gamliel did not just let anybody come in. He only let in the ones that he approved of or the ones that he thought were the absolute cream of the crop of the sages and not the disciples who needed to also learn and be part of it. And he said he appointed bouncers basically at the door. Some people say they were heavenly angels. And they had to check if the people coming in, toho kiboro, that their insides match their outsides. Now, I want to ask you something. How could anybody know if your insides match your outsides? You could be dressed a certain way and be a scoundrel inside. You could be amazing, but not look respectable on the outside because of money or other, or you don't care how you do. There are many reasons. And if you think about it, Rabban Gamliel himself wasn't toho kiboro, because even though he felt his insides were this resolve, this important unity, but on his outside, he created disunity. because he shames people, not everybody, but he shames certain people. So I always find that very ironic that that's why you put the doorkeepers. He said, I'm doing it in order to keep the level of learning very, very high. But look at what happened. On that day, many benches were added. Many benches, meaning benches in the study hall. One second, I had something about the benches. Yeah, so the benches, oh, here it is. Rabbi Yochanan said there's a difference of opinion on this matter between two people. One says that 400 benches were added, the other says 700. And I want to say, it's hard to imagine at that time that there was a room that was big enough that could hold as many benches as were in there, and another 400 or and another 700. And this exaggeration is on purpose to show us how many disciples were kept out. So many of them were kept out because of what Rabban Gamliel had imposed, this restriction. And look at what happened. It was taught, there's a tradition that the tractate of Ediot, now the tractate of Ediot is a complex and difficult, I'm let down in the footnote, is a complex and difficult tractate that is a collection of many varied and different laws that were told, Ediot means witness, that were told by a wide variety of sages. But there's a tradition that on that day, Ba'oto Hayom or Bo Bayom, on that day, the whole tractate was filled and was finished. Why? Because so many people were let in, and this one said, I remember it this way, and that one's like, oh, right, that's the way it is. So I imagine that they divided among the tables. You do the conversations in Adiot about ships, and you do the one about this, and you do the one about planting, and you do one, and then all these tables filled it because they had enough people, and they had people who had knowledge. So look at how much Torah was learned on that day. And everywhere in the Mishnah or in a Praita, which is like a Mishnah, that they say on that day, it's referring to that day. There was no law whose ruling was undecided in the study hall that they didn't explain and arrive at a practical halakhic conclusion, meaning all outstanding laws were resolved. Imagine on the docket, right? You have a whole list, whole list, whole list. They got through all of them on that one day. And that's when Rabban Gamliel realized how much of a mistake he had made. And he said, perhaps, God forbid, I withheld Torah from Israel. That's exactly what he did. By being so severe and tough, he withheld Torah from Israel. And that's when he said, I'm going to apologize. I realize this is showing me that the way I acted was a mistake. He said, that being the case, I will go and apologize to Rabbi Yoshua. When he reached his house, he saw that the walls were black. Now, the reason they're black is because he was a charcoal maker. But he's saying to Rabbi Yoshua, oh, I deduce that you're a charcoal maker from the walls. And Rabbi Yoshua was like, really? You didn't know that before? You're my teacher, and you don't even know that I'm poor and that the walls of my home are black because I have to work at the most menial of jobs? How do you not know that? This is another flaw in Rabban Gamliel's character, and Rabbi Yoshua was really upset and taken aback that Rabban Gamliel did not take the time to care about each and every student to make sure that they were okay. So Rabbi Gamliel says to him, I apologize, forgive me. But Rabbi Yeshua said, nope, he didn't listen to him. Finally, after a few times, I skipped that, Rabban Gamliel says, please do it out of respect for my father. And then Rabbi Yeshua became reconciled. So at this point, I feel that Rabban Gamliel was my hero. Rabbi Yeshua became my hero as well. The people who appointed Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah were definitely my hero. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was my hero for stepping in a very hard spot. Even his wife, who was extremely practical and pragmatic, by telling him, I'm not sure you should do this, but I guess she agreed in the end. So I get that. I think that's important for your partner to be like that. Okay. Once Rabban Gamliel apologized, then the people, the rabbi said, wait a minute. We really need to bring Rabban Gamliel back because we need Rabban Gamliel's knowledge. We need his weight. We need his gravitas. We need his leadership. But we can't depose Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. So one rule is because once you raise something up, you can't lower him. So he can't be nasi and then lower. If we let one teach one week and one teach the next, it will cause jealousy. Therefore, this was their resolution. So again, they were my heroes. Rabban Gamliel would preach for 3 weeks. He would be the he would be, so it's clear that he's the leader. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria 1 week. And from that day on, it was a brilliant idea, actually. Rabban Gamliel knew the bouncers will never be put back. Oops, sorry about that. Didn't mean to do that. Got a little thumbs up emoji up there. The way they did it, they balanced it really, really, really nicely. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria, who really was young and was not really appropriate to lead the whole nation, he had 1 week, which allowed his brilliance to come out, and he was a really good balance and didn't let Rabban Gamliel, like Rabban Gamliel always knew, it's like checks and balances. You know, I can't really get out of line. If I get out of line, you know, Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria on his week will rescind it. That's the story. Eddie. Where do we, what do we do now?
Thank you so much. Yeah, friends, now we're going to open it up to questions. Anybody that has a question, feel free to put it in the chat or go ahead and unmute. Thank you so much again. That was incredible. I would love to start off the questions if that's okay with everybody. This is fascinating. I think that there's so much to gain wisdom from current applications of what's going on right now, especially with folks running in high emotions. In your mind, when is it appropriate, or is it ever appropriate to speak up, feeling like you have to speak up, even though you know it might shame others in the room?
know, that's a really good question. I could imagine in a place, I mean, shame is always hard, but if you were in a room where somebody is bringing people down, let's say, taking it from nowadays, down a path that would lead to violence, that would lead to hatred, that would lead to inciting. I don't know if shame is exactly what we're talking about, because I don't know if they would feel shame. They might feel that they're, you know, invincible in that moment, but I think you have to speak up. So that's a really good question. Shame, when is shame allowed? Is it ever allowed? I mean, you know, it's always best to take the person aside and try to reason with them. We also have people who cannot be reasoned with. We also have Jews who cannot be reasoned. I'm not saying it's only non-Jews. And I think it's always worthwhile to try to find what will be really helpful in the moment. It might seem like in the moment calling somebody out is going to help, but if it actually won't help, maybe the right thing to do is to find another venue or another methodology for getting there. In other words, will shaming, here's a better way to say it. Will shaming accomplish what I'm trying to accomplish? Not necessarily. It might make me feel bad, better in the moment, but if it won't actually accomplish anything because the other person is impervious, you know, here they're all together. All the rabbis are in the room and they're all on the same page, so to speak. If you're talking about today when people are so conflicted and so, at odds with each other and even truly hatred, I don't even know if shaming would enter the arena. And does it accomplish what we want it to accomplish? I mean, what it did accomplish here was that the entire nation stood on their feet and didn't allow it to continue.
Thank you. Looks like we have another question here. Does Darhei Shalom trump speaking out when someone shames you, or would you call out Lashon Hara if it's calling it out? I'm not certain what.
Okay, let me think about, understand the question. Thank you. Thank you, Torah teens. Does Darchei Shalom supersede speaking out when so ah. So if you're speaking from a place of sh where you were shamed, that's really hard. When somebody's in a place of shame, it's usually there's power, there's a power struggle. Person, because to be able to feel shame, there has to be an imbalance of power, otherwise that would not be the emotion that you feel. I think I would call out, should you say Darchei Shalom or call out Lashon Hara? I think it's 100% to call out Lashon Hara, meaning if it was truly inaccurate and wrong. The big problem is, you know, we're mixing together a few things. It could be that you deserved it, right? It could be that actually what they said was correct, but you don't need everybody to know about it. So Lashon Haras, if they're What are some of the words for Lashon Hara in English? Hotzaati ba, I can't remember what they are, but they're saying it could be true things about you and it would be shameful. So you're not going to tell them, oh, you're transgressing, 30 transgressions of Lashon Hara, because if you are shamed, very often when there actually is shame, there's some element of truth in there. It's not usually based on 100% lie, or your response might be anger or might be something else. So just saying, in the case of Rabbi Yeshua, he did actually tell the student something opposite. So that element was true. Yeah. Okay, what's the best plan to chew for? You're welcome, Torah Deans. Isaac Blumenthal, what is the best path to tshuva for causing shame? Oh, for sure, for sure, for sure. It's apologizing, possibly publicly apologizing. And apologizing for both what you did and for causing the shame, and really retracting, but not retracting like, oh, 3 months ago I wrote a T instead of an L. Sometimes we see retractions in newspapers which we feel like nobody's gonna see them. It's buried somewhere. So it's really hard because you can never go back to the pre-shaming, but for sure it's asking, and they may not forgive you, by the way, and you still may be willing to go to every effort to retract what you did. And I think one way in general when we apologize is we want to show why we're right. So we want to say, well, I apologize. I'm sorry I made you feel bad, but, and that but can take away from it.
I have another question for you, Rabbi. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Isaac.
Is there any ways for some folks who feel like I have to have dialogue, but I feel like I can't because there might be an inclement of some sort of shaming to happen, even if it's that's public or not public, if like I have to call out something. And to further the conversation, and I hope this is appropriate, but I see a large division within our Jewish community right now happening. I would say it's a smaller group of folks who are really outspoken and bringing in a lot of harm based off of what's happening in Israel.
Right.
And that conversation is a very tricky conversation to bring in, where it's like, do you call them out or and cause shame, or like, how do you have these conversations?
So that's like the question, right? How do you have the conversations? You have to have a partner to have the conversations. I think if you don't have a partner, it's not going to cause shame. That's not going to be what you're going to trigger. They're just going to dismiss you. They'll be like anger or retorting or trying to shut you down. Shame, I mean, this again, this year was not brought specifically in order to address the situation today. But when does shame happen? I think that's a crucial question to address. When shame happens, often when there's some element, just trying to think, I read something, trying to remember what it is. I can't remember exactly. But somebody can cause shame by, oh, I read it in a book. Okay, so it wasn't real, but it could have been, where a teacher said something that was, it was actually not truthful about one of the students, don't know why. And this student was shamed. There actually was no element of truth in it. So maybe I was wrong about that. Maybe that's more embarrassment. I'm not sure if there's an element of truth. Maybe I have to think about that. It was actually untrue, but that student had no way to fight it. Like they said, no, but, and when it was discovered that it was untruth, it was too late. So I think that the discourse today does not revolve about shame. I think it revolves around righteousness, anger, exaggeration very often, hyperbole. And not willing to see nuance. I think the conversations today that are so difficult are because they feel so black and white. Can you hold more than one narrative? Can you think one way and understand that there's actually hurt, or that there's more than one story going on here? It's hard if you isolate one story, then the people in the other stories, I mean, honestly, that's just I'm not going to address it, but I'll say there's a story of the hostages. There's a story of those who were killed on October 7th. There's the story of the family of the Chayalim, and Chayalot, the soldiers who are in danger. There were those who died. There were those who were wounded. There are many, many innocent people. I don't know which ones are innocent, which ones are not, in Gaza or Gaza who are being killed. I don't know if the numbers are true, but some of them must be true, whatever that number is. Are they really, do they not have enough food? I don't know. But that's more than one narrative. And when you hold on to only one narrative, I think you don't allow discourse. You only then around allow discourse among those who agree with your narrative. I think that's a problem. So even those who hold a different narrative, they're not willing to hear your narrative. And it's really hard because when you feel so strongly, or somebody who was just hurt by it, whether physically, emotionally, whatever it is, it's really hard to hear the other narrative. But I mean, I don't know if this will happen, that there will be so many places to have discourse where people hear more than one narrative and are willing to listen to it. Because it's not even enough, let's say, for me to come and say, I'm willing to hear your narrative. There's no discourse if the other person is saying, oh, great, let me download all my hurt on you. I don't really care about your hurt. I only care about that won't help either. Unless both sides come with a willingness to hear and to try to hold more than one. So I just think shaming isn't so much what's happening. I think feelings of helplessness happen. I think helplessness is strong. Anger and a lot of hurt and not knowing what the future will bring. But people, like everybody, really is asking, how do we get together? How do we have a discourse that will actually, Rabban Gamliel could have found a different way. He could have said to Rabbi Yehoshua, I know that you don't agree with me, and you're learned, and I really understand that when somebody came to ask you, you said your truth. You said your truth. And I still think that the value of us all pulling in the same halachic direction. I don't like to use the word Trump for many reasons. Just it's whether you are for or against, it just feels like not a good word. So we could say supersedes. That the value of everybody pulling in the same halachic direction supersedes your need to say your halachic truth. Or you could say, I believe that it's, I can't remember if it was let's say, optional, but our halacha that we follow according to our nasi. Is that that's considered now a minority opinion, and we are all going to follow that it's obligatory or the opposite, whichever one it was. So that's a way to have discourse because you're holding all the pieces. You're saying them, you're not leaving them out, you're addressing them. So Rabban Gamliel could have said it that way to Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yoshua could have. So he could still be my hero and he still could learn to do it a little better. So he could have said to the students a little differently. He could have said, look, I don't decide halacha. Rabban Gamliel and the people in the Beit Midrash decided together. That's another way of answering. So, that's how I'd answer these questions. And thank you for making me think of them. I never know what questions are going to come up.
I love that. Thank you so much. Friends, if anybody else has any questions, go ahead and type it on the chat. If not, we are running out of time and want to respect everybody's time for joining us today. Thank you, all of you who are taking the time out of your day to start this morning, evening, wherever you hear the recording. Such luscious, grounding Torah to be able to illuminate us. Thank you so much, Rabbanit Jaffe. I really appreciate you. You're getting lots of little emojis coming up here.
Oh,
And thank you.
awesome.
This has been a great, great class, as always, coming in with great, powerful Torah. We really deeply appreciate your time. Thank you so, so
Bye,
much.
everybody. Have a good
Take care.
day.
Bye-bye.